This is Games as a Podcast. Awesome. Ethan, good day to you. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Just had a restful break. Got a chance to find out if Xbox really is everywhere on every device, and it turns out it is. And
I hear that's the promise.
Yeah, it's worked out really well, at least for people that are willing to put up with some friction. Got a lot of fun out of my MetaQuest 3 and kind of understanding what AR is all about. How about you?
Yeah, it's been a good couple weeks.
So playing games on the go is a really important thing for me now. Just about anything I play, I want to make sure that I can access it on multiple screens. Because a perfect example was last night, I wanted to play Dynasty Warriors. My wife and daughter were watching SNL documentaries on the big screen upstairs. And I had multiple ways that I could handle getting back to my game. I ended up choosing PlayStation Portal, which is a really good way to hack into the experience and keep going. But I could also have gone downstairs and played on my second PS5. I just need to be able to have that flexibility. And it seems like I can have that now with all the major platforms. And of course, moving forward, I'll be able to do it natively outside the house at a Starbucks or Pete's Coffee, no matter which device I'm using, it sounds like. And that's also super cool. But Microsoft has already given us a taste of that. So the whole Play Anywhere pitch that we've been hearing from Microsoft, I am one of the earlier adopters of this that can say it works really, really well. So Indiana Jones, I started playing on my Xbox Series X, which is on my big screen TV upstairs in the living room. When I couldn't do that, I'd go downstairs and play on my PC. Then we had to go out to visit the in-laws out in North Carolina, so I took my MetaQuest 3 with me, and when I was able to get a little tech break where, you know, I could take a pause in conversations and catching up to just relax and enjoy a game, was able to pop that on, and they have an Xbox app that just, through cloud, let me continue my game of Indiana Jones on a giant screen. Which
That's
is great,
pretty cool.
Very relaxing, and it was like having an 85-inch screen in front of me. And this is a house that...
Well, did it feel unwieldy at all? Did it feel like too big, like being in the front row of a movie theater, or...
No, pretty good? I could size it to exactly what was comfortable for me.
Oh, right? That's cool.
Yeah, so and it naturally dims the environment around you, but it's AR, so you can kind of still see everything that's happening, and the screen is locked in one place, so it really does feel like there's a screen in front of you. It doesn't follow you when you move your head. So that was a really good experience. You just hook up your Xbox controller and you're ready to go. And then even when I got back from vacation and my wife said, hey, it's time for you and the son to go get a haircut. You know, we went to Great Clips and we were waiting in a line that was 45 minutes long. And I was able to...
Wait, you waited in line 45 minutes for a haircut?
Yes. That just when you do it during the weekends out here, everyone wants to do it at the same time, and we never call in advance. So.
I see.
Anyway, I was bored. I was waiting. My son had already started to get his haircut, but I was still waiting. And so I pulled out of my pocket a Backbone controller. I thought, let's see if it really is Xbox everywhere. Went through the process of getting the cloud gaming button on my phone. It's not a dedicated app. You have to actually load it up through Safari. But once I went through those steps, I was able to connect my Backbone controller and keep playing Indie on 5G, not even requiring Wi-Fi, and it was nice and smooth.
Wow.
I just couldn't believe that because I've tried those kind of tests before, playing something like Forza, and like if it's 5G, forget about it. It's a frame show, right?
Right, right.
No, this was smooth. This allowed me to do the stealth. There were no hiccups. And so it was truly between my Xbox to my PC to the MetaQuest to a phone on 5G, I could seamlessly play Indiana Jones and it would just pick up where I last left off no matter what device it was because of cloud saves. And that's incredible.
That is pretty awesome.
It's also very early because, as I have mentioned to you before, like how many people are waiting for their haircut and just happen to have a Backbone controller in their pocket?
Right.
That's pretty unusual. There was friction trying to get the cloud gaming to set up in the first place because there wasn't a dedicated app. You know, the MetaQuest 3, obviously, a lot of people don't have that. So my experience was pretty unique. But this is emblematic of what it's like to taste the future, to be trying something that you know is going to be big 5-10 years from now.
Definitely.
Eventually, all the hiccups are going to be gone, and we're just going to be playing wherever we want, and we're not going to think about data caps or the speed of your connection or anything. It's just you're not going to think you're buying a game for PlayStation 5. You're just buying a game, and it runs on everything.
Well, I think Microsoft and PlayStation probably have other ideas about from where you buy the game. Or actually, you won't be buying the game anymore. We're kind of already in that phase where we aren't buying games. We are purchasing licenses to play the games that could be revoked. But I think that that will be amplified with these services, platforms as service. So you are in the Xbox ecosystem and you have a library of games that you have access to. That already exists, but amplified through having these quote-unquote dumb terminals that you're playing on. So it's less about the hardware in your pocket or on your at home versus having a screen that you can play whatever you want, whenever you want, wherever you want.
Yeah, and that, of course, will negate the need for dedicated handhelds and all this other stuff we got excited about. And it all just merges into one solution. And I think that that's going to be great. And as I said, it's not there yet. There's still too much friction. But I like being among the first to taste what it's going to be like.
Definitely. And it's a confluence of a lot of different evolutions of technology and games we're seeing. So the portability factor, the cloud gaming factor, I mean, those are probably the two primary ones. Trans-platform, meaning the fact that a game is on Xbox means less and less these days. So, and these are all things that we've witnessed monumental improvements, and I think it'd be cool to talk about some of those. So maybe portable gaming. So obviously, we used to play Game Boys, and the trade-off in terms of visual fidelity was marked between your console at home and your little Game Boy that you took out with you. We still enjoyed it because, hey, we were playing games out in the car or out and about or whatnot. So Game Boy obviously was a huge hit and was kind of the, not an endpoint, but a significant milestone in portable gaming. So I remember having little portable Nintendo games that were basically LEDs that you flipped the clamshell. We were talking about this before we started recording. Totally remember those, like could play Super Mario Brothers or Donkey Kong, but not both on the same thing. You owned each one for the different titles. Even before that, Mattel had these series of portable gaming devices that were basically just moving LEDs on screen to play football, or if you bought a different one, you could play basketball, play soccer. I still, it burned into my brain is just that sound of kickoff on the football. And then you would get a kickoff and try to run it back for touchdown. So the Game Boy was basically the final boss of those kind of gameplay, which also offered putting in a cartridge and being able to swap out games and having some memory in them and whatnot. But they succeeded in bringing to the mass market that kind of style of gameplay. But there were other players making incremental improvements or trying to do it and failing. And I think we have some pretty good memories of some of those.
Oh, sure. And to add to that, so the Game & Watch games you're talking about from Nintendo, the value of those were always that they were big brands. So you had Zelda, there was Mario, there was Donkey Kong. And you're right, it was a situation where you would buy each one individually, and that was, I'm sure, part of the marketing plan. Super interesting then that in that same era, it was not Nintendo, but Milton Bradley with the Microvision that were actually experimenting with, hey, what if you just got one device and could swap out the cartridges? And of course, Nintendo adopted that for Game Boy. And that's how for many, many years we would do handheld gaming, was just one device and cartridges. But the future was foretold in part by Nintendo's brands and in part by the cartridges that Milton Bradley introduced. And yet, when you were playing the Microvision, you didn't have any sense that you were necessarily tapping into the future, and yet there you were.
Definitely, definitely.
Well, Chris, as you know, whenever we record this podcast, you can see two of the 8 arcade one-ups that are surrounding me. And I like going downstairs to my workspace and feeling like I am living inside an arcade. Such a cool thing. And that is a feeling that I've had my whole life. So back when I was a kid, One of my strongest dream memories was that I dreamt I got a Donkey Kong Coleco personal arcade machine for Christmas, and it was so vivid that when I woke up, I was looking for it and realized, damn, it was just a dream. But I wanted...
Wah, wah.
Right, I wanted that so badly. And fortunately, over time, I was able to get that machine and two others. I got Pac-Man and I got Zaxxon. And I don't know if you remember the LCD Coleco machines, but the cool trick that they did was that the games were as shitty as any other LCD games. But the packaging, it felt like you actually had the cabinet. It had the marquee display. It had the paneling that was arcade accurate. And even the controls were designed to look and feel like the original. The Zaxxon control felt like a tiny version of the real thing.
Yeah, I remember. I do remember them. They definitely nailed it with the design to give you that kind of home arcade feel, even if the experience was as far away as possible from an actual arcade experience in terms of just the visual fidelity. I remember the Zaxxon. I think my neighbor had it, and it was so fun to play. It was pretty frustrating because it was kind of, I think it was isometric, right?
Yeah.
Kind of top down. And the depth perception wasn't quite there. And so it was trying to emulate a 3D kind of gameplay, but it was not so... You had to kind of... It almost became like Dragon's Lair in terms of memorizing where you had to be at any given point in order to not blow up. But it was still, you know, it's fun to play the dream, so to speak.
Yeah, and obviously it really is just a toy that looks cool. But boy, did it look cool. And yeah, I just think it's funny that when I was a kid, I wanted to surround myself with those. And now I can do it with effectively the real thing.
Absolutely. I also remember when I was a kid, I had a Pac-Man watch. So it was giant LCD screen, you know, grayscale. Play. It was pretty fun, actually, especially because it was on your watch and it had a little nubbins for like a joystick, but it also came with like these little plastic sticks that stuck down into the nub that probably broke in like 15 seconds or so, but it was still cool to kind of pretend like, hey, I can play an arcade game on my watch.
I'm also positive that made you into a total chick magnet to be walking around with that.
100%.
But I remember the little arcade stick. That's such a great detail. Absolutely. Yeah. And that was Pac-Man Fever, man. That was all over the place.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Well, so another one that struck me, these are all examples of technologies that presaged what would be popular in the future, but at their time were niche and people didn't really understand. I remember going to a friend's house who had ColecoVision, and he was the cool kid because,
he was.
You could play, like, the actual Donkey Kong, or at least we thought it was arcade-perfect Donkey Kong at his house. But he also had Sega's Turbo and the ColecoVision Expansion Module 2, which was the steering wheel. That, to me, was just mind-blowing, that you could actually have a real steering wheel playing this racing game. And you didn't see much of that until like later generations, maybe like PS3 era. But now I have a friend who has this like setup that they've spent thousands of dollars on to just get the perfect feeling for Gran Turismo. And it's mounted and he has a car seat and everything. And this is very much a hobbyist thing. But that was hinted at way back with ColecoVision when you could do that with your expansion module too.
Yeah. It's a small plastic peripheral. Foretold the countless thousands people spend. My next door neighbor's got a full setup. He's got the three monitors and the cage and the steering wheel, and he's into iRacing. There's a big hobbyist element to it, and people build like real-time weather systems that you can import and things like that. And then also extends to stuff like Flight Simulator.
Oh, for sure.
Microsoft's newest version of Flight Simulator is literally mind-blowing, for me anyways, just... You feel, or it looks as if you are in a plane flying around, and it's almost the metaverse in some ways. In terms of you can look at a real time flight and say, "Hey, I'm going to fly that plane," and then there are people that like to play as air traffic controllers, and so it's pretty remarkable. From plastic steering wheel to basically airline pilot level equipment that you're able to use in your entertainment experiences.
For sure. And you could go the other direction also and say that outside of these super expensive peripherals, in a way, it kind of preceded the fishing controllers for Dreamcast Fishing, or maracas for Samba de Amigo and stuff like that. Just the idea of having different ways to control the experience.
Definitely. And it's funny you mentioned the maracas, because that's another area, motion control.
Yes.
So, you know, Sega, obviously we're a little biased, but I don't think it's controversial to say Sega has historically been a very technology-driven company and has often been first to market with some pretty innovative products that sometimes failed to succeed, but definitely ushered in new eras of gaming or types of gaming. And Samba de Amigo was, for me, one of the first kind of motion sensor type activated things that you could play at home. And it was a lot of fun. I think, admittedly, the technology, I think it's because the maracas, I found that if you got too vigorous into shaking the maracas, you could sometimes, the sensors would get a little wonky. So the gameplay wasn't perfect, but having physical maracas in your hands, that tracking your movement on the screen, was just really a fun experience that really I hadn't played before, certainly not at home. Interestingly, Sega was a pioneer in motion control in the preceding years in the arcade. So motion control has been around in arcades for some time, and Hang-On was one of the first machines that used motion control. You sat on this motorcycle, and it tracked your motion as you swayed back and forth to go in and out of turns. Yeah, that technological innovation kind of ushered in a new age of motion-controlled hydraulics in video games or arcade machines. So it's kind of cool to see that Sega kind of started with that innovation, and it led to being able to do that at home with Samba de Amigo, even though Samba de Amigo was a little rough around the edges.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think also about Afterburner, which had the hydraulics and made you feel like you were really in the cockpit. I went recently to take my son to Terminator 2, and at one point, John Connor's in the arcade, and he's playing Afterburner.
Nice.
It kind of, put me back in a time and place. But yeah, it's interesting that the idea of motion control initially was something kind of for high-end arcades. It was this novelty. You'd have to go to a location to even experience it. But then, yeah, when we got to Samba de Amigo, and remember, the sensor was on the floor with that one. You put it in front of your feet, and it just was so joyful. It was so fun to do that, because you'd played video games for, you know, a decade and a half, but you'd never played it that way. You'd never put your body fully into it, and you had to stand to play it too, which was very different. It just really challenged your idea of what an evening of fun with your friends could be with a video game.
Yeah, definitely very kinetic, obviously, because you're moving around, like you said, standing up. But again, because the sensors were on the floor and they were receiving on kind of a plane, when you're maracking around, you kind of shift your body. And so you kind of had to, there was a little bit of a disconnect. It was easy to take yourself out of the experience, because maybe you'd step a little to the right and then the sensor for your left maraca wasn't picking up right or something like that. So, but super cool technology. Obviously, set the stage for Nintendo knocking it out of the park with the Wii and ushering in a whole new era of motion sensing gameplay, especially at home.
Well, and you can take it another direction too. I just realized that if you think about party games for multiple players at one time, where you're standing and playing music, it also kind of was the precedent for Rock Band.
Definitely.
Came before that. And just gave you that same kind of experience where you had the musical peripherals and you were playing with other people to the beat of music. Samba actually beat Rock Band to the punch there, too.
Definitely.
Now, one thing that was interesting is when I was talking to my son about this list, and I was saying, I think this is the first, like, meaningful motion control thing, he said, what about the Power Glove?
Ha! I never had one. I probably saw a million ads for it in various and sundry publications, not least of which being Nintendo Power. But did you have one? Did you play with it?
I was fortunate enough to not get pulled in. I had a friend who wanted it more than anything else for Christmas, and he got it. And it was one of those things where he excitedly asked me to come over and play it. And of course, you could barely functionally play a game using it. It wasn't very fun, but it was his big present, so he had to convince himself that it was cool. But I walked away kind of happily saying, oh man, that looks so cool in the ads. I'm so glad I tried it before making it the one big present that I asked for. So
you didn't want to channel your inner Thanos?
No, no. Remember, it was even in that movie, The Wizard.
Oh, yeah, I do.
So big press for that. But
good,
yeah,
product placement there.
Yeah, and then you mentioned before in a earlier episode that kind of motion control itself ended up evolving into VR.
Yeah, definitely. And even some early iterations of VR incorporated motion tracking. No surprise there. So the unreleased Sega VR headset, which was announced in 91, never really came out, had tracking with sensors, which of course set the stage for future VR developments. Well, of course, the head tracking was there, but Sega was one of the first to kind of try to realize that in a kind of console entertainment experience or a home-based experience.
It's interesting that that's where you could argue that Sega beat Nintendo to the punch with motion control, but also I think that they kind of laid the groundwork for the Switch before that came out too. And that was with the Sega Genesis Nomad.
Oh, yeah.
And this is one that I bought, but I only bought it once it hit like $50 at KB because they were blowing them out. I didn't buy them right away. They clearly were not a hit in the market. You could definitely understand why, because like the Switch, it was the ability to carry your games around wherever you wanted. But you were talking about big, chunky Genesis cartridges that you had to carry. And the batteries, it was 6 batteries that would last about 45 minutes.
It was absolutely
crazy. But what I think is important here is not only could you play it on the go, but you could also plug it into your TV when you got home, and you could plug in a wired Genesis controller and play it as a Genesis machine. So it was a Switch, just an early version of it that was terribly inefficient with batteries.
It was a portable Genesis. It was pretty amazing. It's analogous to the early car phones, which preceded cell phones. You know, there were these gigantic boxes that you could put in your car, and if you had a battery, so you could theoretically take it out of your car. And I remember there's a scene in Wall Street where I think it's Michael Douglas is on the beach, and he's like, "You know where I'm talking to you from? I'm on the beach." And it's this gigantic phone.
Yep.
So that was kind of the Nomad. Very cool technology. Certainly hinted at what the future was, but was a commercial failure. Probably because people went broke replacing the AA batteries.
I remember carrying my Nomad with me to wait in a 2-hour line to see The Phantom Menace. So, and I remember I had NBA Jam and Street Fighter that I brought. And
nice.
I thought I was just the coolest kid in the world among this line of fellow nerds playing the Sega Nomad.
You were the coolest kid in the world for half an hour.
Yeah.
And then it died.
So, and by kid, I mean like just about to graduate from college, to be clear.
Yes, well.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that was an interesting one. And of course, there was the TurboGrafx Express that probably should be mentioned as well, because you could do those same things. And actually, the Turbo, and Dai Kudo, if I remember, like his family came from like the Hudson Konami background that created TurboGrafx. You know, we know someone from there if we haven't worked on that stuff ourselves. But the thing that was interesting looking at that was, again, unlike the Game Boy, which were these kind of adaptations in pea green that were not what the actual Castlevania or Mega Man games were. They were kind of poor man's ports.
Yep.
It was super cool to be able to take the TurboGrafx around. And instead of chunky cartridges, they had these little Hue cards that were very small and easy to take with you.
Very expensive.
Yes. But you could just pop those into the back of your TurboGrafx and play. And so, again, that was another example of kind of getting to the Switch before the Switch. Also very battery intensive. But I remember the solution there for multimedia was you could actually connect a TV tuner to it as well.
Very cool. Your mention of TurboGrafx reminds me of another entrant in the promise of kind of home arcade, and that was Neo Geo.
Oh, yes. That's a perfect example. Yep.
I remember, I think it was the richest kid on the block had them at the time, because they were, I think the machine was like $800 or something back then, which is a large amount of money, probably over $2,000 in today's cash.
Oh, and the cartridges were $200 each.
Yeah, they were. It was a very expensive proposition. The quality of graphics were so amazing. It was literally an arcade experience in your home. And to people that could afford it, it was amazing. I remember also, I think in college, there was an actual Neo Geo arcade cabinet, and it was the exact same machine, just in a cabinet form. So you could play these stunning, stunning arcade games in your home. And that was kind of, the, I think, the first example of bringing arcade, actual arcade quality experiences home. Of course, consoles went on to surpass what arcades were do today. Arcades rely more on the physicality of the machines and what you might do, how you might interact with kind of unique, bespoke elements. But Neo Geo was the shit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that is something that we actually do see today. So when we just saw at the Game Awards the footage of the new Virtua Fighter.
Yep.
I have no doubt that anywhere in the world that still has functioning arcades, there will be a push to get that game put out as an arcade. I mean, I'd be shocked if that wasn't the case. But at the same time, exactly the same game will be available on PC and console.
Yep.
And it's going to be the same code base. It's going to be the same hardware. It's not this huge difference where, you know, there was a massive delta between the hardware architecture for Virtua Fighter and the Saturn, mm-hmm. for instance. It's going to be the same, just like the Neo Geo was.
Yep.
So you're right. Neo Geo did kind of foretell that future. And it was very exciting to see that, though I never personally knew anyone who had one. So I worked at a software, et cetera, and I certainly would sell cartridges. And I would ask, like, what do you do for a living? I just had to know, like, under what context do you buy a game for $200? Especially, remember, these are, like, basically 45-minute long games that have unlimited continues because it's an arcade game.
Yep.
So that's a pretty expensive 45 minutes, especially in 1993 or something like that. So
yeah. Do you remember the answer? Was it an investment banker?
I remember doctors and lawyers, literally. Oh, okay. Doctors and lawyers. Yeah. So I don't know in, you know, the middle of America, how many investment bankers necessarily were coming into the suburb software, et cetera. But there were definitely doctors and lawyers. You know, in some cases it was just rich guys in their 30s that were buying it for themselves. And other cases it was like very lucky kids that were getting amazing Christmas presents. But, you know, to live.
More things change.
Yeah. To live that childhood, I guess. Now my kids are living that childhood because they get that, you know? Also, what's just funny to me too is it's like emotionally now when I'll go to the Nintendo eShop, those games are all on eShop now for like $8, right? As opposed mm-hmm. to $200. And that just blows my mind. And I could like fill my son's memory card on his Switch with Neo Geo games and he probably wouldn't even get around to trying them. Whereas when I was a kid, I would just die to get a chance to play those unlimited.
Yeah. It just underscores how much has changed in relatively short time.
Yep. Well, so I wanted to head back to 1997, a little bit after where the Nomad was, but Tiger Electronics, they had their TigerGame.com handheld that actually had a stylus and touch controls prior to the DS. So people got so excited about the DS when it was announced and all the cool features you could use with it, but it was not first to market with a handheld game-focused device with stylus.
Mm.
Now, DS was the first one with good games on it. And that's pretty important for the life of a machine. But I thought it was interesting that there was someone that beat them to the punch there.
And did you play the game.com?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, it was a running gag. There was a Batman Forever game, I think, that had Batman, he would moan in agony every single time he was hit. And it was such a bizarre sound because the sound effects on a device like that are horrendous. And so
tinny at best.
Yeah, yeah. So years after the thing came out, EGM, Electronic Gaming Monthly, had their own podcast. And they would use that as a constant clip. And I was in the office at the time when that was being recorded. And so whenever someone didn't like a game, you just hear the Batman. Whoa.
Oh, it was part of their soundboard.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So it kind of lived on there. But yeah, the games, what was so terrible about it was all black and white LCD displays, and so they'd get these big licenses like Mortal Kombat and Sonic, and you'd think, oh, cool, it has all the big games, but they were barely recognizable on the device. It was absolutely awful, but they at least had some engineers who had some interesting ideas. So, Chris, looking back at that era, another one that I thought was interesting to look at was the 3DO.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember when Trip Hawkins released that, and his whole vision for it was that 3DO was going to be like VHS? Or DVD. It was going to be something that was a technology everyone licensed.
Media type, yeah.
Exactly. It was just going to be a media type. And they actually put their money where their mouth was. Panasonic supported the Real 3DO player. That was the first one. Mm-hmm. I remember, again, I was at Software Etc. selling that for $700 when it came out, and there was Crash and Burn and Shelley Duvall's It's a Bird's Life, and that's about it for a while. But eventually there was a Gold Star version of the device that was cheaper, that still ran all the games, and that didn't seem like it was going to come to fruition as kind of a model for games until we just recently saw that the Steam Deck, the Steam OS, is used in Valve Steam Deck, but also in the new Lenovo device that gives you the option of Windows or Steam OS.
Yeah, and that's probably just the start. I think consumer electronics manufacturers are realizing the value of Steam inside.
Yep. For sure. And so also, of course, you're going to be seeing it with all of the streaming solutions. We already saw there was PlayStation Now that was built into some of the Sony Bravia TVs. There's been announcements that I believe some of the Samsung TVs are going to have Xbox and Game Pass cloud streaming functionality in it.
Steam won't be too far behind. I'm sure of it. There will be TVs with Steam OS installed, so you basically can access your games directly to your TV, which is huge.
Yep. So, you know, Trip, you did have the right idea all along. And it's cool to see, even though it's taken more than 30 years, your ideas come to fruition in a big way.
Yeah. Hats off.
Yep. So going back to Dreamcast for a little bit, we talked already about...
Always.
Yeah. We talked about the advancements that Samba offered with motion control, and that was really cool. But there were a couple of other things they did that were ahead of the curve. The first one I want to point at is the VMU. So
for sure,
that is dual screen gaming. That gives you
that's a stretch. I think it was very innovative especially for a storage device to put that screen on there, and it did allow for some pretty compelling gameplay. Is it dual screen gaming a la the DS? No, but I agree with you. It definitely was an innovation and brought some really cool gameplay.
Well, you had pointed out in another podcast the value of being able to do your football play calls, and that especially
absolutely
multiplayer.
So cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, especially because it's couch co-op. You're sitting next to your buddy, and previously you're picking your plays on screen. They're picking their plays on screen, and you know, you want to do the right thing, but it can be very hard to resist, especially when competition is fierce. And I think it also just kind of creates more of a real life football experience. You're kind of in your huddle, you're picking your play through the VMU, and then you go out and do it. Super cool. Yeah. And then Sonic Adventure allowed the Chao Racing and Chao Racing. There was a lot of cool stuff you could do with the VMU. You could upload graffiti. Download graffiti and modify it and upload it to your game of Jet Grind Radio. A lot of really cool things. And the slot for the controller also allowed for some interesting styles of gameplay or peripherals to plug in. So you had the microphone, for example, which allowed for an online game like Alien Front Online for you to talk to your teammates.
Yeah.
Or one of our favorite quirky little titles allowed you to play Seaman, so you could speak to this little ute-faced critter in a terrarium and try to nurse them to evolution.
Well, and we've now seen kind of the cutting edge when you see at CES or at GDC these demos of being able to walk up to a character that's an NPC and ask them in-world questions. And they have guardrails mm-hmm. so that they don't know what they shouldn't know about the world. So mm-hmm. you can't ask them about the details of a crime boss's like day-to-day work schedule, because how would they know that? Guardrails make it so that they can't answer that. But they can answer questions about where they got the recipe for their ramen and stuff like that. It's kind of cool, and you can insult them. You can make them happy, and they'll all have guardrails that will give you hopefully an authentic experience. We haven't seen that in a mass market game yet, but clearly that's around the corner, right?
I agree, and maybe we can talk a little bit about AI in a sec, but let's stick on the Dreamcast. So another innovation, we've talked about this in the past, but I definitely think it's worth noting, is the Dreamcast was the first with the online connectivity out of the box. And maybe it's not pertinent for this discussion because it wasn't half-baked, it was fully baked. You could have a fantastic online experience, and I think that was the first time, certainly the first time out of the box that you could do that, which is definitely notable, but maybe I shouldn't have brought it up because it's not particularly topical for this discussion about things that were initial glimpses of the future. But it did, I guess it did. Certainly the gameplay back then wasn't as amazing as online gameplay is today just because of the advent of broadband. But you did have a pretty robust dial-up experience.
Well, I would say that if we want to look at the version that preceded that, that was the failure that just kind of pointed to the future, was SaturnNet.
Yes.
So on Saturn, you actually could connect to a fully functional 56K browser. And that was a very slow experience. Or 56K connection to a browser. Yeah. I'm talking to someone who would definitely know the details and differences there. Yeah. But yeah, so just to say it was not broadband, simply, you know, much like the Dreamcast.
Yes, Sega Netlink, right? It came out in, I think, 96, which is
crazy,
pretty remarkable.
Yeah,
it really is.
And I remember using it with, I think, an Opera browser, but it was I was actually able to surf the web on my Saturn, which is kind of neat.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I don't remember doing much else with it, frankly. And obviously, it's a doorstop now, but interesting that they
just went to Yahoo and clicked links.
Yep, but it's cool that they made that possible at that time.
Absolutely, but maybe more interesting is that that was not the first foray into online gaming for Sega.
Oh, we're going back further. That's right.
In Japan, you could actually go online with the Mega Drive in 1990 using Sega MegaNet, which operated through a cartridge and a peripheral called the Mega Modem. And you could play a total of 17 games online. This is not something I did, but I went into the internets to look up a little bit. They tried to release something called the Telegenesis in North America, but it was never released. It did actually release in Brazil in the mid-90s.
Interesting. Yeah. I remember in the U.S. there was also the Sega Channel.
Yes.
For Genesis. Yep.
That was a game distribution system. Yeah, that was in tandem with cable television operators. So I think it depended. It was kind of regional and depended on where... who you had for your cable TV at the time.
Yeah, but I was really bummed that it just didn't happen to be in my Time Warner cable area, because I would have loved to have had that. And it had some exclusive content, at least for a while. There was like the Mega Man Wily Wars and stuff like that that you could only get that way, which I thought was pretty neat.
Yeah, it's super cool. And I think it hit like 250,000 subscribers at its peak, which is pretty remarkable given... The penetration of online gaming at the time was pretty low, so not bad.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember there were also some online solutions, like third-party solutions, to play on Genesis Mortal Kombat, where it would link machines together and things like that. Again, a choppy experience at best, but there was definitely a desire to make that happen early on.
Absolutely.
And going back really quickly to C-Man, the reason I was bringing up the AI stuff with what's happening today is that C-Man was very much like that, but back in 2000, 2001, where the whole point was talking to a character and having very rudimentary AI determine what you were saying. It would recognize words through the microphone. You could make him happy. You could upset him. I remember there was a mechanic for slapping the Seaman.
You could slap it. I think in the early stages of the game, you tapped on the glass to try to get them to acknowledge you. So it wasn't just talking, but it was a combination of talking and interacting with the terrarium to try to get their attention. And then eventually they start talking to you and you... Yeah, it definitely was it was kind of an evolved version of a Tamagotchi in some ways, because you had this terrarium that you were trying to create and sustain and evolve life, but then kind of look forward to, like you said, these more robust NPC experiences that we kind of take for granted now in an RPG that AI is poised to kind of turbocharge. Yes, I think Sega kind of was forward-looking in terms, or Yute Saito specifically, in terms of kind of having this experience where you really have this truly interactive experience with the pixels on the screen, which is pretty remarkable for the day.
So, Chris, you're talking about online experiences, and one that I think is interesting in being a predecessor to Doom, you could argue, is that on the Game Boy... You could play a game called Faceball 2000, which was a four-player linked
game. From the future.
Game. Right, yeah. It was a linked game, and it was in first person, and you would look for other just giant faces that was what you and the other players in the game were controlling, and you would shoot. And it was a very simple mechanic, but it was effectively the first LAN first-person shooter that I think ever came out.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. I remember really enjoying playing head-to-head Tetris, but I never heard or played Faceball. So it was, you'd say, would you call it, go so far as to call it an FPS?
I think that that's definitely stretching it. You had a reticle and you could shoot balls. It's not like there was a gun in your hand. So obviously a lot less sophisticated than Doom, but you could experience how fun that type of play would be. And so as a result, I would come in early now and again to Software Etc. and hook up with a buddy of mine, and we'd play on link cable before opening Faceball 2000. It was just a fun thing to do, and we'd try to encourage people to buy it, and very few people did. But I'm sure that the people who did get it had as much fun as we did.
Yeah, it's kind of a hint at all the Xbox LAN parties to come.
Yeah, for sure. Or, you know, all the QuakeCons and everyone linking up their machines, you know. So kind of neat, though, that happened on the least sophisticated hardware possible at the start.
Yeah, very cool.
I want to talk a little bit about VR as well.
Let's do it.
So VR, of course, one of my pet topics. And I remember when the Virtual Boy came out, they were marketing it as Nintendo's first 32-bit machine. And you had to position it on a table and rest your face in it. And it would create tremendous eye strain. I owned one, but I only got one after Blockbuster had this very generous rental program, and I had rented it. And within what felt like just a few months, it went from rental to $50 in a box, get this crap out of our store. And that's when I picked it up.
Yeah.
But I believe there were fewer than 30 games ever made for it, one of which was the only licensed game based on Waterworld, which is kind of strange. But it did have some a couple bangers on there. It had a really good Wario game. It had Mario Tennis, which was really good. Tolero Boxer, which was kind of a, you know, Rock'em Sock'em Robots thing. And it was,
I think I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, it was neat, but it just, you couldn't play it comfortably for more than 15 minutes.
No, it was, I remember not really enjoying it. Kind of gave me a headache. You kind of had to lean forward and push your face into the device to establish a good seal. And it's going to be a tough sell, I think, full stop, just because you obviously can't really port to it. You have to design the game and build the game specifically for the device. So it's not super surprising that it was a little half-baked and a little ahead of its time. And I think, you know, sadly, or for better or for worse, maybe VR has kind of been in the state for decades. I feel like it's always been on the cusp of breaking through, and certainly today the tech is closer than it's ever been. But if you look at it compared to the game market at large, VR is definitely a niche market, and we have talked about it at length before. I think it's worth noting that Virtual Boy kind of hinted at the entertainment possibilities. For me, it was actually the arcade machine Dactyl Nightmare, where you have this huge headset, and we talked about this before, which really, it was a new kind of experience. It definitely kind of felt immersive and felt different. And certainly this latest generation or wave with Oculus and Vive, it has leaps and bounds better than the predecessors. But I would argue it's not fully baked, and there's some just inherent challenges, I think, with the VR space, and we've talked about those at length, and maybe we don't need to retread, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, people have been chasing that dragon for a very, very long time, I guess, is the bigger point. And what's interesting looking at Virtual Boy also is that it's not really virtual reality at all.
No.
It's 3D. That's really what the effect was. It was a different experience in each eye that gave a 3D impression, and Nintendo actually did master that on the 3DS. And that still is a pretty remarkable piece of hardware, especially the new 3DS XL, which really helped lock in the 3D experience where you could like move your head and it wouldn't break the illusion. Really cool stuff. And if you look back on the machine now and you turn on the 3D, every single time I do it, because it's like, you know, I'll go 5 or 6 months without playing 3DS and then pop it in, it's like, whoa, that's really cool. It's a neat thing.
Yeah, that is cool.
But I thought for sure that like Vita and every other handheld device and phones would all start using this glasses-less 3D technology, and that never actually happened.
No, it didn't. It'll come out as soon as smell-o-vision is a thing.
Maybe so. Maybe we got to wait till then. But yeah, and then when you're talking about the actual location centers with VR, we do have like Sandbox VR now, and there are still mm-hmm. things like that that have Star Trek and Ghostbusters games that are pretty neat. So yeah, both Virtual Boy and Dactyl Nightmare, that was ahead of its time for sure. Now, cloud gaming, boy, that has been something that has been pushed, you know, since we were in earlier days at Sega. That's been...
Last 25 years, at least. Not dissimilar to VR, actually. Not surprisingly. You know, games has always been at the forefront of technology. So as long as there's technological innovations being done, there's going to be some sort of application to gaming. So it has been on the cusp for a while. And I think we're just now starting to see the promise realized, which is pretty exciting. But, you know, before Stadia, RIP, before GeForce Now, before Xbox Cloud Gaming, there was OnLive and Gaikai, which yep. we both experienced.
Well, and I think that a lot of the early hype on those platforms came from people who were so excited about what it could do that they were just technology-focused folks that were very forgiving about what they couldn't do.
Yep.
And I fell into that bucket for a while. I remember when PlayStation was doing the PlayStation Now service, and mm-hmm. I was playing at a Starbucks the Watch Dogs, and I posted on social media, I'm getting a flawless experience playing Watch Dogs on Starbucks Wi-Fi. And Mike Gallo, who we've had on the show before, simply responded with, "I don't believe you." Right? And and almost certainly, like, he was probably right. There was never at that time and place a perfect experience of cloud gaming, but boy, was it cool. I remember, Chris, I was so excited about the remote play functionality also that was on PlayStation 4s, and the fact that you could tunnel in and play on your machine. I'd be finding places when I worked at Sega that were close enough to go to lunch where I could take 15 minutes of that lunch to play like Dragon Age the Inquisition or Assassin's Creed 4. I remember the Melt was conducive to that for some reason. And like, it was a ridiculous thing to do. Why would I want to like take just 15 minutes to set up and play a game? But it's just because I could.
Could, yeah. Yeah. We're techno nerds. So you want to flex the technology and enjoy it. I remember playing OnLive at E3 in 2009. And I was impressed with the technology. It was a really interesting tech demo, but it was pretty lacking. I found that latency was definitely an issue. There were glitches. And maybe that was a victim of the notoriously spotty internet at E3, but it seemed like it was kind of a pervasive issue for OnLive in general. So just a little before its time, probably. And I also played PlayStation Now. I found it somewhat decent, certainly improved from OnLive, but it was overall kind of lacking. And flash forward to today, or even just a couple of years ago, Stadia was the first, I think, solid cloud-based gaming platform. I think NVIDIA GeForce Now has caught up to Stadia by now, but that, you know, 2-3 years ago, I was blown away by how good the technology was for Stadia. And of course, those foundations were laid by the likes of OnLive and Gaikai, which offered experience, but it was a little subpar compared to just plugging in your console to your television. But today, it's a much, much different story.
Well, Chris, are you an iPhone or an Android guy?
I have an iPhone.
Okay, me too. And that, for all the things I love that Apple has brought to the gaming ecosystem, the one thing that has constantly been a challenge is these streaming platforms. OnLive, I remember, Android, you could actually play the games, but on the iPhone, the app would only let you watch streams of other people playing because they wouldn't allow you to stream the game. That was, you couldn't stream games on the Stadia iPhone app. And even now with Xbox, you go to the Xbox app and they push you through a whole bunch of loops to create basically a web app icon for cloud gaming. And so clumsy, and Apple knows that, I'm sure, and that's not their first priority.
By design.
Right, exactly. And so that's one of those things where this technology is such a cool idea, but the one device that has a screen that I literally carry with me everywhere that's super powerful, that is totally capable, is blocked constantly by the hardware manufacturer for these types of technological advances. And that's frustrating.
Sure. Well, you could play Stadia through an iPhone in the Chrome browser.
Yeah.
So that was a solution. So, but yes, that bespoke app didn't work. And I think those days may be changing. Certainly, there's increasing pressure on the walled garden holders of Google and Apple. I think start to see easing of those walls. So hopefully that will decrease the friction of games operating between these different platforms or devices or screens, basically. Back to cloud gaming, though. So OnLive and Gaikai were not the first players. They probably the first ones that saw even remote mainstream adaptation, even though both of those kind of failed in that, even though Gaikai, I guess, got slurped up by PlayStation for the technology that evolved into PlayStation Now and then absorbed up into PlayStation Plus, I believe. Back in the day, in 2000, there was a company called G Cluster, which was a Finnish company, and they demoed it in 2000, released in 2003, originally hoping to deliver games direct to end users. Unfortunately, it didn't pan out, but they did get a significant investment from technology or media companies in Europe, namely Orange and SFR in France. And they actually used their technology to deliver games, streaming games, to their cable customers, to cable television customers.
And they actually lasted a long time. They just shut down at the end of February this year.
Oh.
Pretty remarkable for a company that started 25 years ago, a technology company that started 25 years ago and still kicking around today in some form or another, even though it didn't quite realize the dream that they were trying to accomplish back then.
That's really interesting because it's those untold stories. Like for me, OnLive was the first. That's what I knew of. So I'd not heard of this G-Cluster solution before. That's super interesting. And it's also very telling when there's a technology that everyone's chasing that they want to be first to market on. And David Perry, I remember, was who is at Shiny, was involved in Gaikai. And talk yep. about Guy being in the right place at the right time selling to Sony.
Yes, and I think it was a pretty canny move for them to sell themselves to publishers and developers of games as kind of a demo experiential platform.
Yeah.
So Gaikai was around basically to offer streaming demos of games. So it made a lot of sense for an EA to partner with Gaikai because it's basically advertising for their big titles, whereas OnLive was a subscription service to play games in the cloud, which kind of rubbed some of the IP holders the wrong way because it basically was a barrier. You had to pay the subscription and then get access to the game. So I think it was a pretty smart move for Gaikai, and not surprising that they kind of succeeded where OnLive was not able to.
Well, and I think one of the other challenges is when cloud gaming was the talk of the town, people thought it was going to be the next big thing. That's when single-player games were most popular and open-world games. And if you think about it, the cloud gaming solution is much better for a single-player game like Assassin's Creed that can have very forgiving hitboxes.
Absolutely.
Than live service games that are competitive, where a Marvel Rivals, you have to trust and rely that your speed is the same as somebody who's playing natively if you're playing against a native player. And you just can't have that feeling of confidence, I don't think, necessarily, in cloud gaming.
Yes, I think that certainly multiplayer gaming is a little more challenging from a latency perspective. Not impossible, but the biggest barrier to entry is that as we've talked about, a lot of these network multiplayer competitive games are free to play, and the financial implications are pretty significant. So Fortnite running in the cloud would cost Epic billions of dollars against their P&L, so it's in their best interest right now for players to download and run Fortnite locally, and then they just have to worry about the latency and making sure that everyone's connections to the server are okay. Will this change over time? Probably. I'm not sure when. It's going to take a significant amount of infrastructure and lowered costs of bandwidth and storage, etc., to get to the point where it makes sense to try that kind of business model. But I'm sure it will happen at some point. And unfortunately, as we're kind of seeing, though, the early movers may not be the winners. So
yep.
I expect that someone will probably try it and it likely will not succeed. However, someone will follow in the failure's footsteps and succeed where they couldn't.
Well, and that's where I think we can kind of close off, is just saying that if you are really interested in new technology, you're going to repeatedly get this opportunity to try the next big thing before anyone realizes that's what it is. And you'll hear people 5-6 years after you've played something like VR or Light Cloud Gaming say, wow, this is cool. I can't believe what a big life you know, change it is to be able to stream games wherever you are. And you've done it forever, right? And it's kind of fun to be in that position. That's one of the most exciting things about embracing new technologies.
It is fun to be there. I think you also need to kind of have the understanding and attitude that stuff is often half-baked. Stuff may not live to see the next year or a couple of years down the road. And us having both worked at Sega, it's been exciting and exhilarating to be working for a company and with people that are pushing the boundaries. But oftentimes Sega has not been able to capitalize on those early movie advantages. So it's fascinating and sometimes frustrating and maybe even heartbreaking in some cases, especially if you're working as opposed to experiencing it as a consumer. But it's exciting.
Yeah, and I also got to look back on that Sega frame and say how cool it was to work for a company that would listen to a pitch for something like Seaman that not only was bizarre on its face, but required a pack-in peripheral. And the response was, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Let's do it. Yeah, I still want to play. I think Seaman should be rebooted, and I think it would be fun.
Yeah, I think that's one of those experiences that if you ever tried it or even watched someone else try it, it's so bizarre that you'll never forget it, and there's a special place in your heart for it. So,
yeah, awesome. So much, you know, technology is always exciting. Yesterday's has been, can sometimes be tomorrow's winner, and that's what kind of makes it exciting to always be looking for whatever's new and interesting.
Yep. Well, Chris, appreciate talking through this with you. It's been fun to do this deep dive and look forward to catching you next week.
Yeah. And if anyone out there has a story that they'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear it. We'd love to hear your experiences and checking out the newest, latest and shiny stuff. So please let us know. And thanks, Ethan.
Thank you.